Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Last month, the FDA approved the first trials of embryonic stem cell therapy for human patients, paralyzed patients with spinal cord injuries. Stem cell research is coming in from the cold and is once again promising medical miracles. Potential treatments, even cures for spinal cord damage, heart disease, Parkinson's, diabetes, and maybe much more. All this as new methods of creating new cells from adult tissue may bypass debate over human embryos entirely. This hour on Point will look at the leading edge of stem cell research, back from exile and ready to go. You can join the conversation. Are you hoping that stem cell therapies may one day save you or someone in your family, someone you love? Are you ready to let the research roll? We have two big leaders in the field with us today. Joining me now from West Palm Beach, Florida, is David Skadden. He's director of the Massachusetts General Hospital's Regenerative Medicine Institute and professor of medicine at Harvard University. He's co-director of the Harvard Stem Cell Institute. David Skadden, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Tom.
Great to have you here. Also with us from Philadelphia is John Gearhart. In 1998, he led one of two teams, his at Johns Hopkins, along with James Thompson's at the University of Wisconsin, that first isolated and identified human embryonic stem cells. He's now director of the University of Pennsylvania's Institute for Regenerative Medicine. John Gearhart, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
So, we all watched the drama around stem cells with President Bush in office. We're in a new administration now. A lot of talk that the U.S. was sidelined. Is American research ready to rebound, John?
Well, it surely is. I think we all have a sense of relief and joy at this development, but also a dash of, I think, realistic anticipation as to what this new policy, the form it will take. And obviously then the funding that would be available for it.
David Skadden, there was a lot of talk in these recent years that the leading edge had gone overseas and might stay there. How do you see that now? What's the balance of research between U.S. and the rest of the world?
Well, I think there was a great concern among young scientists in particular that with policy being what it was, it would be difficult for them to be in this field and be able to support a career in science. And they also were concerned about the risk of potential criminal sanctions. So this has lifted that cloud. It will make a big difference, I think, in terms of our ability to get junior people here engaged, fully active, and I think it will really unleash a whole new wave of innovative science.
We're going to look at what some of those innovations may be, but John Gearhart, standing here right now, as far as I know, Barack Obama has not acted on this yet. What is expected, anticipated? You say there's realistic anticipation. Is there some particular policy move that would let loose a flood of new research? Is the research happening anyway? Is Obama going to what?
Well, that's what we are waiting to hear, exactly the form that this new policy will take. We have before us a policy put in place in 2001 by President Bush. We have an executive order in 2007. We assume that both of these, one policy statement, the other executive order, will be revoked. We don't know, though, what the president will say going forward as to how he will establish or what this new policy will be, whether he will turn it back to the National Institutes of Health, which a decade ago, that's where we were. This is the organization that has taken up on many issues, not just on stem cells, the development of what national policy will be in the funding of biomedical research. And finally, we don't know whether there will be any legislative action to codify whatever a new policy will be. So we're waiting to hear what that policy will be. But my dash of, or more than a dash of realistic anticipation, of course, in this economic time, what practically can be done from the standpoint of infusing money into this area of research.
Anticipation has been great for a long time. So has resistance. Here's a little tape from 2004 at the Democratic National Convention. Ron Reagan, son of President Ronald Reagan, spoke out there in favor of stem cell research, painting a pretty glowing picture of medical breakthroughs to come.
These embryonic stem cells, they could continue to replicate indefinitely and theoretically can be induced to recreate virtually any tissue in your body. How'd you like to have your own personal biological repair kit standing by at the hospital? Sound like magic? Welcome to the future of medicine.
Well, but wait just a minute. President Bush issued the first veto of his presidency when Congress passed a bill to lift restrictions on federal funding for embryonic stem cell research. Here he is in July 2006.
This bill would support the taking of innocent human life in the hope of finding medical benefits for others. It crosses a moral boundary that our decent society needs to respect, so I vetoed it.
George Bush, July 2006. David Skedden, I wish you'd paint as broad stroke a picture of what happened to global research on the stem cell front during these years, the Bush administration years. Where did it flow and how did it get around and beyond and through the policy which restricted the use of embryonic stem cell lines?
Well, one important thing to recognize, Tom, is that it constrained the use of federal money, but it didn't prevent people from doing the work. So In a few universities, we were able to actually get private funding or funding through foundations that allowed some of the work to move forward. Now, of course, it doesn't take full advantage of the genius of America, if you will. So there were only a limited number of people involved. Other countries, of course, saw this as a huge opportunity to get involved in what seemed to them and to many of us the most exciting new area of biology that could have an impact on both the kind of medical care and, frankly, also the business of medicine. And so other countries invested very heavily. And as you know, some of the states also got very active here in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And that has created winners and losers within the context of American science. And the hope now is that we'll be able to all be on a level playing field and let stem cell science compete with the rest of science for its opportunity to use federal dollars.
And John, what about at the level of the dream? You heard Ron Reagan describing it there as the possibility of a personal biological repair kit standing by at the hospital. Is that still the vision in this stem cell research world?
Well, I think it is. As the work has progressed over this decade, we have come to appreciate more and more the potential of these cells. We've made, I think, obtained tremendous insights into what these cells are about. We've been able to utilize that information, as was mentioned earlier, to now perhaps derive cells without the use of embryos with the same properties. We see many, many experiments coming forward, what we call proof of principle, in which we've been able to repair or to have animals recover different functions based on the use of these kinds of stem cells. So clearly, I think the dreams are still there. The form in which some of this may be translated to the clinic, though, may change over time, but still, I think the dreams are there.
David Skedden, I'm looking here at a news report from the Yomiuri Shimbun, Japanese newspaper, from Keio University in Japan just today, saying that researchers there have succeeded in mending spinal cord damage in mice by transplanting into them neural stem cells. Action almost every day. You've been quoted in Time magazine recently saying, keep your seatbelt on because this ride is going to be wild. What's the ride you're expecting, David?
Well, you know, one of the things I think that some of us felt when Ron Reagan was speaking at the convention was that this idea of having that toolkit was that was a little bit overblown. We were all wincing a little bit because certainly there was a lot of optimism, but there wasn't such a thing quite possible then. In the course of the last 2 years, much of the science has actually been turned on its head. We now have opportunities to be able to create just such a toolkit. In much more realistic terms, I think many of us feel that actually this field now is exploded wide open, not just because of policy changes, changes in the attitude around science by the administration, but also by the science itself.
Now, you've got stem cells. They can turn into any of the 200 different kinds of cells in the human body. Is that the toolkit we're talking about where, I don't know, you need bone, you make bone. You need kidney, you make kidney. You need neural pathways, you can remake them. Is that the vision, and are we getting close to it on some fronts?
Well, I think one of the other important areas here is that if we can now take cells from any adult individual and make them into these cells with a great potential to become anything, if you imagine now for people who have had degenerative diseases for which we've had both very few options and very little understanding,
like
someone who has something like ALS, mm-hmm. Lou Gehrig's disease, mm-hmm. In those individuals, usually we don't make that diagnosis until fairly far along in their disease. You can't just do samples of the brain to study what's going on. Now we can actually potentially take cells from their skin or from a hair follicle, create a pluripotent stem cell. That cell can then be made to become the neuron, the very specific nerve cell that is damaged in that disease, examine it in the laboratory, create essentially a model of that disease now in a petri dish, and have a chance to both understand it better, but also apply different medications that may have an impact on that. So in addition to the idea that we might have cells that really come from that person that could be used as replacement therapy, mm-hmm. we also have an opportunity to potentially develop new medicines. And I think that dual approach is one that we think really will open up the doors for lots of new kinds of therapies for people.
I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the leading edge of stem cell research and where it's headed now. It's getting closer to big changes in the way we treat some of our most difficult medical conditions. With us, John Gearhart from the University of Pennsylvania Institute of Regenerative Medicine, and David Skadden, co-director of the Harvard Stem Cell Institute. And John, David, I want to get right to our callers and their many questions. David, in Columbia, South Carolina, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'd like each of your guests, with some specificity, maybe to enumerate the top two or three applications of this research in the short term, say over the next 5 years, and then in the longer term. And I'll take their comments off the air.
Let's do it. John Gearhart, first to you. Top two or three applications, short term and further out, on your list.
Right. Well, I think the definition of short term is critical here. Your caller mentioned 5 years or so. I think one of the first areas that this technology will be applied would be in the area of heart disease. I think we've made sufficient inroads in demonstrating that cells derived from embryonic stem cells can be used in animal models of infarcted hearts, heart attacks, in rebuilding hearts. Sufficiently to greatly improve the functioning of those hearts.
So this would rebuild heart tissue, actually reconstruct parts of the heart that have been essentially killed in a heart attack or something?
That's correct, that have been lost. This is mainly the muscle mass of the heart.
Mm-hmm.
I'm quite encouraged by experiments throughout the world in this particular area. And, of course, cardiologists are aggressive in their treatment. They have to be. For saving lives here, and I think that this is one area.
How would that work, if I may ask? Our caller asked for specificity. To get us thinking along these lines, how does or would that actually work?
Well, following a heart attack, as you know, a region of the heart is lost. The blood supply is compromised. Cells die. And it would be important either to introduce a cell replacement that could, in effect, rebuild that not only the heart muscle but also the blood vessels that are associated with it, and to have it match the patient, of course, so that it's not rejected.
Does that mean it would have to come, the original cell, from the patient, him or herself?
That would be the most desirable approach,
mm-hmm.
Again. Through the new technologies, it's demonstrated that these cells from adults that have been converted to this embryonic-like stem cell can produce the tissues of the heart and can be engrafted and improve outcome in animals. Now,
my layman's curiosity here, again, sort of practically, what would that mean? Would you inject some kind of cells with this special potency into the heart and then they would reproduce there? Or would you have them reproduce outside then graft them onto the heart?
The experiments that have been done to date have involved really growing these cells in the laboratory in a dish in a more embryonic form than the adult cell, than the heart cells of the adult. These cells are then grafted into regions of the heart where the blood supply has been compromised and cells have been lost. Mm-hmm. Now, this is one strategy. Another strategy that we know about is that these cells also produce what we call factors. These are substances that are that can help in the repair of the heart itself, the intrinsic cells within the heart, and prevent further damage. So the combination of cells plus some of these factors have proved quite effective, at least in experiments in the laboratory. Now, Tom, I think you have to appreciate it is a long distance from something that's been demonstrated in an animal to get it into the clinic, into a clinical trial. And this really takes years, as you know, going forward. So
to our caller David's question, could that some therapy along these lines used in the population be 5 years off, 10, 50?
I would think that what is required in gaining approval of the Food and Drug Administration for clinical trials and getting through clinical trials, that in a general sense, it's going to be more than 5 years off.
David, let me go to you for a short-term application and your definition of what short-term might mean. What one or two would be at the top of your list?
Sure. Let me shade it a little bit differently than John. I'm a hematologist-oncologist by training and
a blood man.
A blood and cancer doc, right. So I definitely am a believer in the use of the cells as therapy because in those fields we already use stem cells, adult stem cells, for the treatment of people. But I also, as a physician, recognize that actually our quiver is fullest with different drugs. And I think these stem cells are actually going to enable us to identify drugs that can have an impact on diseases in a way that I mentioned before. We'll have models for disease that we otherwise couldn't study. Now we'll be able to take compounds that might already be available that are out there for other purposes, see how they might affect something like the neuron affected in Parkinson's disease or ALS or a number of disorders, and see, can you have a protective effect? Can you have an ability to potentially delay the onset of the illness? Those kinds of contexts might allow us to be able to get a medication into the clinic in a fairly rapid term, and that would be something that I think we'll see over the course of the next 5 years.
So they're not direct stem cell therapy, but diagnosis and modeling with stem cell science that allows the more personalized and targeted application of medicines. What about a direct therapy? What and when?
Well, you know, I'm actually very encouraged by the fact that the FDA, as you pointed out last week, said that they are now comfortable that there have been the milestones established to be able to use an embryonic stem cell-based approach in patients with the kind of monitoring that they need to have to feel comfortable that it's safe. So with that in place, as you know, a trial is about to begin for people who have spinal cord injury. I personally also think that the recent developments of being able to get cells to become insulin-producing cells suggest that we should be able to test this in the setting of type 1 diabetes within a fairly short interval of time.
Describe the spinal cord hopes. Is this a solution to Christopher Reeve's problem, bless his soul, when he was with us? Is it that kind of answer? Those who've broken or had damage to the spinal cord actually would stand up and walk again?
Well, certainly everyone would, of course, want that to happen. But realistically, what this first study is trying to do is to just determine whether using these cells is safe. If there is any opportunity for the nerves to grow back through what is typically a scar that prevents any effort of nerve cells to regrow into the injured area, this is often prevented. The hope is here that providing the cells that came from embryonic stem cells may, in a sense, give conduits for those nerve cells to now grow back. if they grow back at all, if they give any sensation of touch or any other control of things like just the bowel and bladder, that would be enormously valuable. I don't think we can realistically expect that there'll be a full restoration of function, but any step forward would be enormously powerful.
Full restoration, not now or not ever?
I don't know. I don't think we know. Certainly from animal models, there is a suggestion that you can repair function sufficiently to be able to have animals that were previously unable to move around have a considerable amount of motor control. Not the ability that they perhaps had without the injury, mm-hmm. but something that would still give them a lot more ability to function and perhaps be a lot more independent. But again, that may be a very long way away. What we first have to do is just determine whether it's safe.
John Gearhart, you looked to heart disease and rebuilding in the near term. Look further out for us here. Our caller asks, longer term, what applications is your eye on?
Well, we have been involved in the spinal cord area as well. We've been involved in some areas of stroke, for example. Again, in laboratory settings where we can have absolute control over the timing of events, we are encouraged by being able to introduce cells into, for example, an animal's brain in which we've generated a stroke, and to show recovery not only of motor function but also to some degree cognitive function. We are encouraged by this, but again, it is a long way off, I believe, years off, in any application to humans. There are a variety of other diseases that we are working with. David had mentioned type 1 diabetes, mm-hmm. Clearly a major target of a number of laboratories, and we're encouraged by recent results there. So it's to me, a little bit difficult, I'll be honest with you, to predict when any of these would be in clinic. I'm sure it will happen, but we can't say definitely in what form it will occur at this point in time.
And when you say in clinic, you mean sort of on the shelf at the clinic and ready to go.
That's correct. Mm.
Let's go to Bill in Omaha, Nebraska. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I have more of a comment. I have Parkinson's,
mm-hmm.
and I've been living with Parkinson's for about 10 years now,
mm-hmm.
and when I was first diagnosed, all my friends said, oh, in a few years there'll be something that will cure you. Well, I've learned not so.
Mm-hmm.
I have to live every day with guarded optimism. We have, I participated in the risagiline drug trial, which took 8 years, and that's just for a drug for maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
And we have marvelous doctors here in Omaha at the University of Nebraska, one Dr. Howard Gindelman,
mm-hmm.
is working on a vaccine for Parkinson's. But this stuff is going to take a long time to come.
So your friends, in no doubt looking to buck you up, were saying, you know, it's just over the horizon, but you've learned to temper expectations.
Correct. With good intentions
of course.
On their part.
Sure. Bill, good luck with it, and let me just key off of that with you, David, if I may. I mean, there's that hope, but very tempered expectations in time terms now. How do you line that up with your comment, keep your seatbelt on, this ride is going to be wild?
Right. Well, you know, this is the big issue, I think, is that we have enormous steps forward that, frankly, were not predicted. We don't know when those will happen. Those things have made a big difference in terms of the way we think about the cells and the kinds of experiments that we do to try to get to the clinic. But it still remains a very long journey to be able to say that a specific disease will have a particular kind of therapy. And, as a cancer doc, I can tell you that dealing with people's really desperation to try to find something new and balancing that against the hope of science is always a difficult, difficult thing. I feel the need for patients to look to this as something that can provide the opportunity down the road. I also want to reassure them that we're all trying to do this with the greatest haste as possible, mm-hmm. and yet realizing that we're dealing with very complex biologic issues that take years and take unexpected turns as we go. But again, looking back 2 years ago, if you had said that someone could actually turn the history of a cell back from being something that was highly specialized like a skin cell, mm-hmm. and now with just some relatively simple modifications, be able to turn it all the way back to a pluripotent stem cell, that would have been a laughable notion. So revolutions do happen. We're in the middle of one.
Let's get a call from Wellesley, Massachusetts, and Ronnie. Ronnie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm the mother of three children, and my middle child is a son, mm-hmm. and he has a rare genetic disorder called Schwartz-Jampel syndrome.
Okay.
And I am pretty certain that during his lifetime there will be no treatment available to him. But in the small chance that we could help further science, we saved the umbilical cord blood from his youngest sister when mm-hmm. she was born. Mm-hmm. And our geneticists, who are at both at Johns Hopkins and at Mass General, pretty much told us that, you know, no one could predict if ever a trial would come up to try to see if some sort of, you know, gene therapy could right. be done to help with this condition. But we felt that this was our only chance mm-hmm. to save this. And so, you know, it's an expensive thing to do. Every mm-hmm. year we pay a bill, you know, a lot of the money was up front. But, mm-hmm. you know, I intend to save this because who knows what 20 years or 30 years will be part of. And since his condition, you know, people estimate that he's one of potentially 87 people in the world who has this
wow.
condition, it's not exactly top priority yet. Mm-hmm. Internally within, you know, NIH, there are, you know, studies being done. So we just hope that eventually our hard work and money will pay off, that we can help further science.
You've got your hopes, and you have his sister's umbilical cord blood, and good luck to you, Ronnie. John Gearhart, what about it? This issue of embryonic or umbilical cord blood or cells from adult, adult cells turned back into pluripotent cells, as David described, is it clear where the most important source of these cells is going to be?
No, it isn't, Tom. I think our contention 10 years ago was that we had come up with another source of cells that could be considered eventually for therapeutic utilization. We, in any institute, look at a variety of sources of cells and their use in any given particular situation. And this is what we had asked for 10 years ago, just to be on the playing field, that we could put a very powerful new source, mm-hmm. the embryonic stem cell, into that mix.
Mm-hmm.
So we are hearing results from cells from adults, from umbilical cord blood, from embryonic stem cells, really in the laboratory for the latter. So that's all we were asking. We don't know where the most effective, let's say, therapy would be at this point.
But, David, we've just got 30 seconds before the break. It appears that dependence on the embryonic stem cells may be significantly less than people thought just a handful of years ago.
I think that's true. I think that they still remain the gold standard for the pluripotent cell, so they are not an obsolete technology.
Pluripotent meaning it can kind of do whatever it needs doing.
Exactly right. Can become any type of cell. So now we have the potential to make other cells become that way, but we're not sure that they're exactly identical. And so we still need to have, I think, at least a few years of comparison between them. But I'm optimistic that we will be able to move further away from that.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the leading edge of stem cell research and where it's headed now, getting closer to big changes in the way we're told that we treat some of our most difficult medical conditions. We're moving from a Bush into an Obama era, and that may make differences as well, though stem cell research at this point has traveled all around the world. We're joined today by David Skadden, co-director of the Harvard Stem Cell Institute, and from Philadelphia by John Gearhart. He is director of the University of Pennsylvania's Institute of Regenerative Medicine, both right in the thick of the leading edge research we're looking at today. And David, John, you know, people come bearing the hopes, sometimes desperate hopes of their own families. Let's go to Omaha again. And Judith, Judith, you're on the air.
This is Judith.
Hi, Judith, you're on the air.
I'm fine. I'm celebrating. I have tears in my eyes. I have a have a granddaughter who was diagnosed with type 1 juvenile diabetes at 4. She's now 18, and of course, we have been waiting for the time when our government can become more involved in the research process through funding. And we're just, I am so grateful. Our whole family is, of course.
Well, let us hope that that research opens wide up for you. And let us look, Judith, at diabetes in particular and how it's being approached. David Skadden, I know this is very important in your lab, where you're a co-director, Melton. Douglas
That's
right. Melton's own children have diabetes. It's been a big motivator for him. What can you tell us about the state of research, stem cell research on the diabetes front?
Well, the idea that one could use cells that were derived from either embryonic stem cells or perhaps these new cells that could be induced to become embryonic-like is something that is proceeding and is a very important area. But there's another whole way of thinking about the problem that was just made possible by an extraordinary experiment that was conducted in Doug Melton's lab. And what he did was in thinking about how now we can change a skin cell back all the way to becoming an embryonic-like cell, that maybe we don't have to go that full distance. Maybe if we just turn back the clock a bit, or perhaps even just try to change the nature of the cell, that we could essentially change its identity. And he showed that he could take an animal that had diabetes, where it had had destruction of the insulin-producing part of the pancreas. And what is often left is the part of the pancreas that's important in digestion. It produces digestive enzymes. And what he showed is that he could use viruses that are typically the viruses that that cause the common cold. They could be used as a way to deliver genes into those enzyme-producing cells and actually change their fate. Those cells then became insulin-producing cells. The blood sugar of the animals improved. So that way of thinking about using what we're learning in stem cell biology to actually just change the nature of cells is something that is also a part of what we're hopeful about in terms of developing new approaches to these illnesses.
So just to be clear, this is instead of anything to do with embryonic, for example, you're taking, in this case, pancreas cells and you say with the virus is kind of like the path in. You go in and you turn the tumblers. You change the genetic code of a cell or cells in the pancreas to change their function, restore that insulin production function.
Exactly right. So this all, in a way, came out of some of the research that was being done with stem cells. The idea that we learned, essentially, from the stem cell work is that you could change the cell state. You could switch the tumblers around. And that didn't necessarily mean that you had to go all the way back to a stem cell. You could actually just switch it to something more functional at the moment, and that would be something like the case of in diabetes of producing insulin. So that's a fantastic, again, something unanticipated development that came from the world of embryonic stem cell research that, as you point out, may not have anything to do with embryonic stem cells, but could have a great deal to do with how we develop new therapies.
John Gearhart, would you just help us think about Parkinson's for a moment? It's been raised. If stem cell research, eventually therapy, was pointed in that direction, what's known about how some therapy might work or unfold?
Well, I want to emphasize something that David had brought up earlier, and which seems many times to get lost in the discussion of stem cell research and therapy. And that is that through stem cells, we can tell you that we've identified a cell source that could be used for replacement. But partnered with this, we must understand more about the disease process in a variety of these diseases for which we're seeking therapies. One of the arguments would be, and there is some evidence of this, that if you even find a cell source that you can replace cells that have been lost due to a disease process, that that doesn't necessarily mean that those cells will survive, that they too can succumb to a disease process that was existing prior to.
In other words, even if you manage to begin producing the cells again, they might be mowed down as they move into the breach.
Yes, so we have to understand more mm-hmm. about that process. Mm-hmm. Now, David also emphasized that you can use these very stem cells with from patients with diseases to help us understand
diagnose that and
yes,
target
and things. Mm-hmm. Right, but I just want to make clear that just having a source of cells for replacement isn't the answer.
Does this latter path seem more likely in the case of Parkinson's then?
Well, it's certainly now being utilized in this, but I think from the Parkinson's side, we're learning much more about the disease process itself and what is leading to it. And every day there's a new report of some parameter that is involved. We've already been through the process of attempting to generate those dopaminergic neurons that are lost and do grafting experiments, but there is no long-term maintenance of those cells in the grafted animals, for example, or mm-hmm. even in humans that have received fetal tissue grafts, which is mm-hmm. a therapy as well. So
they succumb also.
Well, they may succumb, but the important point is that I think the answer here is that those neurons, which through a complex series of cell interactions have to communicate with a variety of cell types in the brain, don't really hook up appropriately to maintain themselves in these grafts. So they're of short term. So we do have a long way to go to understand how we can turn off a disease process, how we can place a cell in an appropriate position and have it get hooked up, so to speak, within the central nervous system and be maintained and restore function. Now, there are certainly experiments that are encouraging in this way, but I do think this is one of these situations where we are years away from the use of a cell-based intervention here.
Though you can well imagine how closely people listen to every word mm-hmm. you say. David, I hear you there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, Tom, if I could just add to that, I think John is absolutely right that this field is one where people often latch on to the idea that we're going to have the opportunity to use cells as replacement parts. Mm-hmm. But in many ways, that's actually the narrowest view mm-hmm. of the entire field. We have opportunities now to use cells to come up with both better understanding that we think can lead to other kinds of therapies mm-hmm. that, again, don't necessarily involve the cells, only the cells as a model. The idea that this is an area that can lead to cells that replace is one aspect of it. The other is the new drugs. The third is, frankly, just in thinking about disease. I think the stem cell paradigm, for example, has been very useful in the field of cancer biology. And so there are ways in which this whole area of biology will have a wide-ranging effect on medicine and our approach to particular diseases, mm-hmm. far beyond that of the idea of just a simple insertion of a cell.
Let's take a call from Nashville, Tennessee, and Mark. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
I've got a client who has been going to Mexico for stem cell therapy, and he tells me he went originally for his back, but he tells me that not only does his back feel better, but it has lowered his blood pressure as well. I'm wondering what monitoring is there, if any, by scientists in the United States, this foreign gene therapy, or stem cell therapy, rather.
Mark, is he going to a legitimate, you know, sort of bona fide hospital in Mexico or to some, you know, I don't know, back alley in Tijuana? What's his destination?
I don't know specifics on it. My understanding is it's a private clinic.
Mm-hmm.
Let
us pick it up. We've got the question. David, how about it? Looking, I know there's a lot of research going on abroad, but here, you know, he's going down from Nashville for therapy. Is that really out there?
Well, certainly there are lots of opportunities for exploitation in this field. So there may be some areas where there is new work going on that will result in a big breakthrough, but it is always concerning when people are going to private clinics where there is very little information about how people have done with that therapy, where there's not really, in some ways, the bright light of regulation and reporting that is required in other countries like in the U.S. So I am very concerned about this. Again, as an oncologist who has seen many people be exploited by techniques that are projected as being wonder cures, not coming through. And yet people, of course, want to move forward. They don't want to wait
right.
for what is a very slow process in this country. So we have to somehow find a way of balancing that. We've actually, within the context of the International Society for Stem Cell Research, there's been a series of publications put out there to try to help patients who are thinking about involving themselves in such therapies for them to at least consider the issues that they need to ask of those providers to see if they're really getting something that can help them or whether they're getting something that is just there to earn money for the
Good luck to your friend. And a note of caution there, then, Mark, in Nashville. John, let me ask you about – I mean, I'm looking at the United States where you are, Philadelphia, David in Boston, Cambridge, and on around the states in Oregon and Wisconsin, Menlo Park, but also all around the world research going on. Is the United States at the forefront here? Has it fallen behind in the last half dozen years? What's your sense, John, of where the center of gravity of stem cell research and breakthroughs are now and are coming?
Well, it's clear we do see them throughout the world, but I'm not, I guess, at this point willing to yield the fact that the investigators in the United States still aren't leading the pack. I think this has a lot.
You think
to
we
do.
Are? You say?
Oh, I do. There are unbelievable research facilities and investigators here, and just one has to look at the publications, and this is how you measure that kind of thing to a certain degree. But it is only a result of private funding, of state funding, I think, that has really enabled this to move forward. People have recognized this deficiency, have stepped in. It doesn't mean it couldn't be more robust and by orders of magnitude more robust. If we look at the funding over the past 8 years through the Bush administration, only about 3% of a out of a $4 billion budget on stem cell research has been allocated to the studies of human embryonic stem cell research. That number is just simply too low to make an impact. I am optimistic, and we see it every day. So I'm not willing to accept that we don't lead the pack, but we certainly could be a lot further out there.
Let's go to Simon in Middlebury, Vermont. Simon, you're on the air.
Hi. My question pertains to the idea that our imagination seems to far exceed potential research and application actually goes.
Simon, you're breaking up really badly on us there, but I think I caught it, David Scadden, Simon observing that maybe our imagination exceeds our real potential when it comes to stem cell research. What do you say?
Well, you know, this is a field where we've seen tremendous changes in our way of thinking about how cells can be used and how we can generate cells with different capabilities. So that is itself, I have to say, it is one that does provoke the imagination. There's no question about it. It is something that I think is actually a great attraction for many of us to get into this field because at this point, while we've seen certainly lots of hiccups along the way, that the field continues to astound, that there are developments that occur on a fairly regular basis. If you just look at the course of the last 2 years, the idea that you could change cells so fundamentally was something that no one predicted and is now a reality. So, yes, I agree. There is a lot of optimism, a lot of hope, and some of it will be shot down eventually perhaps, but I think there are other developments that will come along that will continue to develop this field. So I am excited and I am keeping my seatbelt on.
John Gearhart, how about it? I think our caller Simon is on to something. I mean, people, they hear the potential. It sounds so amazing. Use a word like pluripotent. It sounds like anything can happen. Brings to mind images of Star Trek where you wave a wand over an injured person and 2 days later they're all back to health.
Right.
Do our imaginations run away from us here, or do you have that same optimism ultimately?
Well, look, there's several aspects of this. One, I think, is number one, managing expectations. When people hear about the kind of science or even as what scientists are thinking about, this is going to be, I think, a major concern going forward on how we manage this. And I'll get an answer to you in one second here, because it's combined with another aspect. And we talk about dreams. I think dreams and imagination in science is part and parcel to being successful. We have got to allow our students and fellows and faculty to dream. This is what sets in motion productive curiosity. Mm-hmm. This is where innovation comes from. Mm-hmm. And so it's a question of when we share our dreams sometimes that people think, you know, is this person sane or not? Mm-hmm. I think in this field, though, we are beginning to realize some of those dreams. And the importance, finally, of having those of having the resources to fund here, dreams without, you know, resources are just hallucinations to a certain degree. We've got to get out in education, outreach, and really make the public understand what this science is about, and therefore we can manage expectations.
But that sounds like a knowing and open mind to the possibilities, and they are indeed exciting. John Gearhart at the University of Pennsylvania's Institute of Regenerative Medicine, thank you so much for being with us. Mm-hmm. David Skadden at Harvard's Stem Cell Institute. David, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for your questions and insights. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.